Ladies and gentlemen, it's time to take the gloves off. Welcome to Politics Lobby 4. Please remain seated. Extinguish all smoking materials. And prepare yourself for the truth. The Politics Cafe. Frontline with Kit Darrow. The Extreme Court. Try to remain calm. This is your last warning. Welcome to Politics Lobby 4.
Ladies and gentlemen and fellow conversationalists around the world, welcome once again to the Politics Cafe at www.hernco.com and the ASI Radio Network. Broadcast from Politics Lobby 4, Secure Our Borders Voice Room on Pal Talk. The Politics Cafe is a small cafe located on an isolated stretch of the information superhighway, where we get together once a week and grill up some fresh topics for your digestion. And yes, there are a host of fresh topics going on tonight. Huge unrest in Pakistan. Lots of bad things going on over there. President Musharraf barely managing to hold on militarily. Getting scolding from Bush. Other odds and ends. I'm going to get into that tonight. I got a few things here that may not seem to be too much on the politics side, but we're going to get into it. Blah, 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 blah. Some news from Hillary Clinton here. Looks like we could get Mukasey for the Attorney General. May work out good. There's some good news from the European front. A lot of good news happening here tonight, folks. A lot of good news. And so much that it's tough to say where to start at. And actually, the second hour of tonight I have planned is going to be a little philosophy section tonight. Brought on by a lot of what was held in the room here today. We had a lot of good discussions in the room here today, and some of it I'm going to carry over into tonight's show because I think it's rather important, and we will get to that. But at any rate, to start off here, I don't know if any of you guys have been watching the news, but I think I may have got a scoop on this one. This came out just a little time before the show started here tonight, but Pakistan has said that it will hold elections by January. Pakistan said that this is by Cameron Hayter and Augustine Anthony off of the Reuters News Network. Pakistan said it would hold a national election by mid-January, and President Pervez Musharraf pledged to quit the military after criticism from the United States for imposing emergency rule. Musharraf has detained hundreds of lawyers and opposition politicians since taking emergency powers on Saturday, a move seen as designed to preempt the Supreme Court ruling on his re-election as president later this month. As president last month. U.S. President George W. Bush, who values Musharraf as an ally in his battle against Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, urged Pakistan's president to lift the state of emergency, hold elections, and quit his military post. Musharraf has detained hundreds of lawyers and opposition politicians. Police used tear gas against stone-throwing lawyers in the eastern city of Lahore and wielded batons to break up another protest by dozens outside the High Court in Karachi. It has been unclear whether paramilitary elections will go ahead in January as scheduled. But Attorney General Malik Abdul Qayyum told Reuters there would be no delay and national and provincial assemblies would be dissolved by November 15th. Ahead of the vote that is supposed to transform Pakistan into a civilian-led democracy. There is no indication of when Musharraf would lift emergency rule, which he justified by citing a hostile judiciary and rising militancy. However, he said today he planned to give up his military role in nuclear-armed Pakistan. I am determined to execute this third stage of transition fully, and I'm determined to remove my uniform once we correct these pillars of judiciary and the executive and the parliament, he said on state-run Pakistan television. Musharraf, who seized power in 1999 and has been waiting for the Supreme Court to decide if his re-election as president, while still army chief, was valid, had to dismiss rumors sweeping the country that he had been put under house arrest. Since Pakistan was formed in 1947 by the partition of India after British colonial rule, it has reeled from one crisis to another and spent half its 60 years ruled by generals. Security has deteriorated since July when commandos stormed Islamabad's Red Mosque to crush an armed Islamist movement. Since then, nearly 800 people have been killed in military-linked violence, half of them by suicide attacks. The United States has put future aid to Pakistan under review, having provided $10 billion in the last 5 years, and postponed defense talks with Pakistan due this week. We expect there to be elections as soon as possible and that the president should remove his military uniform, Bush said in Washington. But softening his remarks, Bush said Musharraf had been a strong fighter against extremists and radicals. After all, they tried to kill him 3 or 4 times. In Islamabad, several hundred lawyers chanting, "Go Musharraf, go," and "The dictator is unacceptable," protested outside courts until police broke them up by force. Several judges were held incommunicado at their homes after refusing to back the emergency rule. Among them was dismissed Chief Justice Iftikhar Chaudhry, who became a symbol of resistance to Musharraf's rule after defying pressure to quit in March. It is the duty of all citizens of the country, and lawyers in particular, to continue their struggle for the supremacy of the Constitution, rule of law, independence of judiciary, and real democracy, Chaudhry said in a statement. There have also been mass detentions of political activists. So it's just a note there. This is an ongoing situation, and it's as folks all remember, this is a lot has been stimulated by the return of their ex-premier, Ms. Bhutto. So there's a real push, I guess, going on over there. I mean, I guess the only positive thing to see out of all this so far is the fact that we haven't really seen a rise in any call for Sharia law there, which seems to be pretty much suppressed by all sides over there, although it is a growing concern, obviously, in the northwest regions of the country. But just something to keep you guys up on. I will be watching this quite hard over the next few days here, as I'm sure the rest of you will be. And if I get any more breaking scoops, I will bring them up as soon as they come out. Okay. Let me see where to go from here. It's a tough one. We are starting to disable North Korea's nuclear arsenal. U.S. experts today launched an unprecedented process to disable North Korea's nuclear arsenal at the key Yongbyon atomic complex under a multilateral agreement, the State Department said. This is a positive first step in the process, said Tom Casey, department spokesman, as the 9 experts begin work to disable the plutonium production facilities at the complex. The team, led by Sung Kim, the head of the U.S. State Department's Korea desk, had in fact arrived in Yongbyon, and they are beginning their activities there in terms of starting with the first aspect of disablement of the facility. Yes, the process has started, he said. Obviously, it's going to be a process that's going to take some time, he added. Casey did not give details on what had been undertaken so far in the disablement of the plutonium-producing reactor at Yongbyon, which was shut down in July under a 6-party agreement. North Korea agreed to end its nuclear program, nuclear weapons drive, in return for aid, security, and diplomatic guarantees under the agreement among the United States, the 2 Koreas, China, Russia, and Japan. Disablement aims to make the reactor and other plants unsuitable for at least a year while talks on total denuclearization continue. The North, which staged its first nuclear test in October 2006, has agreed with the 5 negotiating partners to declare and disable all its nuclear program by year end. South Korea's Yonhap news agency, quoting diplomatic sources, had reported that the chief nuclear negotiators from the 6 nations recently agreed 11 disablement measures at the 3 major plants in Yongbyon. It said these include the withdrawal of about 8,000 spent fuel rods from the 5-megawatt reactor, the only one in operation in the country. Jan Happ said the removal of the rods, which weigh some 50 tons in total, was expected to take at least 6 weeks. The U.S. team was expected to keep them in a cooling pond until a decision is made on how to dispose of them. Good luck. In North Korea, if North Korea goes on next year to dismantle the plants and give up its plutonium stockpile and nuclear weapons, it can expect normalized ties with Washington and a peace pact to replace the armistice which ended the 1950 to 1953 Korean War. So that, there's, you know, really good news on that front right there. Other good news, this one off of Bloomberg, if I can find it in the stack here, for all of you who think that we are not getting too far in, up there it is. I had it right up on top here. I think the Iraq War is still the quagmire that everyone thinks it is. this by Camilla Hall actually came out last week off of Bloomberg.com. Karbala Province, scene of some of the worst sectarian attacks since the fall of Saddam Hussein, was handed over to Iraqi forces after the U.S. judged them ready to take responsibility for security in the Shiite Muslim area. Karbala, southwest of Baghdad, is the eighth of Iraq's 18 provinces to be transferred. Ambassador Ryan Crocker and General David Petraeus, the top U.S. officials in Iraq, said in a joint statement announcing today's handover, Iraqi security forces in Karbala have been successfully operating independently, maintaining their own security for the past 3 months, Crocker and Petraeus said. Working with local government officials, they have demonstrated their readiness to assume responsibility for the province. Today, the responsibility is theirs. The handover of security to Iraqi forces is central to the Bush administration's Iraq strategy. In provinces such as Diyala, northeast of the capital, Iraqi and U.S. forces struggled to contain insurgents and al-Qaeda. Some 28 people, mostly Iraqi police officers, were killed last week in Diyala by a suicide bomber. Karbala City, home of a Shiite shrine, will be a test for Iraqi security forces because it has been a flashpoint between Sunni and Shiite Muslims, as well as being plagued by clashes among rival Shiite factions. Two suicide bombers targeted pilgrims headed to the holy city last year, killing 90 and injuring 160. Clashes in the city on August 28th during a major Shiite religious festival left 52 people dead and 289 hurt. In 2004, bomb attacks on the Shiites in Karbala and Baghdad killed more than 180 people. It's just a step along the way. It's a hard road ahead for us, a spokeswoman for the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad, Marimbi Nantogo, said of the handover in a conference call with reporters today. Hussein, whose regime was dominated by the minority Sunnis, had restricted religious observances in Karbala City, and non-Iraq Shiites weren't allowed to travel there. The city, 90 kilometers southwest of Baghdad, is revered by Shiites worldwide as the location of the shrine of Imam Hussein, a grandson of the Prophet Muhammad, who was killed by a Sunni caliph forces in 680. Petraeus has overseen this year's 30,000-strong surge of U.S. forces aimed at gaining control of Baghdad and the western province of al-Anbar as Iraqi forces are strengthened. Petraeus, in his first report to Congress on the surge in September, said the majority Shiite government of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki must work to heal the Sunni-Shiite divide. The general, who predicted the extra troops could be pulled out in July, is due to report to Congress again in March on the progress of the surge. But good news. Good news coming out of Iraq. Another province handed over, one of the more deadly ones, Karbala. Things are looking very, very good over there, moving right along. Sure as I know, Democrats out there taking this one right on the chin. Ain't much they can do about it. They will deflect. Expect Democrats to further distance themselves from all news coming out of the war with this, and I think it's a good thing. Right now, of course, they are torn up over each other, trying to get in their shots on Hillary Clinton, and that's a good thing, too. I don't really have a problem with that. We also have Michael Bloomberg being touted as running in the race as an independent, and that man is so liberal that he just can't help but do anything but break up the Democratic vote. So go, Mr. Bloomberg. That's the way I'm looking at it right now. All right, other good news on the foreign front, international news here. This actually came down yesterday on a Reuters news network. But Sarkozy and Merkel are to meet Bush this week. This by Kirsten Gemlich of the Reuters news service. President Nicolas Sarkozy will use his first official trip to the United States this week to show France has emerged as a committed European partner following its determined opposition to the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003. George W. Bush will meet with Sarkozy on Tuesday and Wednesday in Washington, just days before the U.S. president receives German Chancellor Angela Merkel at his ranch in Crawford on Friday. Both German and French ties were strained with Washington were strained when Sarkozy and Merkel's respective predecessors sharply criticized the U.S.-led invasion to topple Saddam Hussein. Merkel moved swiftly to mend ties when she took power 2 years ago, but U.S. diplomats say small differences have started to emerge on issues ranging from Iran's nuclear program to Afghanistan and Kosovo, where Merkel's cautious, consensual approach has begun to grate in Washington. In this context, and with Bush's favored European ally, Tony Blair, having left his prime ministerial post to the less amenable Gordon Brown, Sarkozy has become a central player for Washington, analysts say. Sarkozy has really changed the equation, put a lot more pressure on Merkel, said Stephen Szabo of the German Marshall Fund in Washington. He is tough on Iran, which means she can't hide behind the French anymore. The Germans are no longer the only key partner for the United States in Europe. But despite Berlin and Paris's efforts to renew U.S. ties, Merkel and Sarkozy are unlikely to compete against each other. I don't think there's any competition for being George W. Bush's best friend, said Bruno Tetraeus, senior research fellow at France's Foundation for Strategic Research. First, the U.S. administration in Europe eyes largely, in European eyes, largely appears to be a lame duck. The Bush administration only has 1 year left in power. The second reason is that there is no domestic political benefits to be had from appearing as close as possible to the U.S. administration. Now, Merkel sits atop a fragile grand coalition of conservatives and social democrats, where issues such as redeployment of German troops to southern Afghanistan, which might satisfy Washington, are sensitive. In France, voter opposition to the U.S. strategy in Iraq remains high. Sarkozy, a fan of American lifestyle, who met Bush informally during his U.S. holiday this summer, was branded Bush's poodle by the socialists before coming into office. Officials said Iran's nuclear ambitions will feature high on the agenda at both Sarkozy's and Merkel's talks with Bush. The three countries, plus Britain, Russia, and China, agreed on Friday to push ahead with a third round of U.N. sanctions against Iran, unless reports indicate this month that Tehran has tried to address their concerns over its nuclear program. Sarkozy has shown greater willingness than predecessor Jacques Chirac to put pressure on Iran over the nuclear issue. By contrast, officials say Germany is the least hawkish of the three European powers, spearheading diplomatic efforts to persuade Tehran to suspend its nuclear enrichment program. Iran is the number one issue, and it is interesting that Sarkozy is visiting first. Merkel will come into the meeting facing a great deal of pressure for more sanctions. She is in a difficult position, Szabo of the German Marshall Fund said. The tide has really turned in this relationship, U.S. Undersecretary of State Nicholas Burns said in Paris this week. Besides Iran, the two Europeans are also set to raise issues including Kosovo, NATO, and the U.S. missile shield plans with Bush, which is, believe it or not, that's something they're actually going for at this point in time, despite the objections of the Russians. They're not as, let's just say they don't have their heads as far in the sand as the Russians do about all this. Of course, the Russians don't want to lose a trading partner with Iran. You know, they like making all the money they're doing, refining Iran's oil and selling it back to them, plus other things that are crossing their border that we don't even know about, but, you know, it's moving along there. Okay, looking good. I see you're all up and bright-eyed and chipper here, and I just wanted to read some of this news here before we get too far into the program. I do have other things I definitely want to talk about. For those of you who said President Bush, never vetoed everything in the last few years, is hopped on the veto bus again. This one off tonight off of Reuters, just a quickie. The Bush administration threatened to veto the U.S. Farm Bill under debate in the Senate because it raises crop support rates and does not reform farm subsidy limits, Acting Agriculture Secretary Chuck Connor said on Monday. We see very little reform of these programs, Connor said during a telephone news conference, in which he announced the veto threat. I believe this bill can be changed to reflect good farm and fiscal policy. as flaws, Connor cited provisions that would increase support rates for some crops. He said the bill failed to reform farm subsidy limits and did not correct a pick-your-price shortcoming in so-called loan deficiency payments. And the loan deficiency payments, I have no clue exactly what he's going on there. And the pick-your-price shortcoming is another one that's kind of got me a little disturbed. But where I wanted to lead the show at tonight here was down this farm subsidy path. And I'm sitting here thinking, you know, I understand why they got into farm subsidies years ago. You know, there was an awful lot of incommunication between markets, between farmers. A lot of things happening way back when between farmers and each other. You know, a farmer wanted to go and see what his neighbor was up to. He generally took him 2 days to go and do it. 2 days in which he could not afford to leave his farm unattended and go over and find out what the farmer was doing. Farmers rarely actually got to speak to each other, especially statewide, until they showed up at markets in various places with their goods. You know, until such time came about as where somebody got smart and started selling futures on farm goods. Now, futures market is a little funnier. A lot of people will look at it as different. You know, it's basically where people go in and buy whole crops before they're even planted. And it's kind of a good thing, but it's, you know, it can go either way for a farmer. You know, once his crop is sold, his crop is sold. If it's a bounteous crop, he doesn't really make any more money on it. As a matter of fact, he could end up losing some money if he had managed, if he was able to hold on to it and just take it to market and sell it. But by the same token, he doesn't know how everybody else is going about with things and whether or not he's going to show up at the market with the exact same product as a million other farmers and find out that it's worth nothing. So he kind of has a boon in the fact that the speculator will come out there and buy up his crop ahead of time. But, you know, he's taking his chances each way. Now, of course, if he's got a drought or he's got some other problem or some disease or something else affects his crop, well, guess who bought that? And that was the speculator. That was the guy that bought all the futures on his crop to begin with. So it's kind of a hand-in-hand thing. But this is the way the market tends to work things out. But lo and behold, you know, we had the federal government step in and say, look, these farmers are losing a lot of money, and we're going to end up having to pay them so many dollars per acre or so many dollars per whatever it is they're growing, you know, in order to keep prices low for the people and to keep the farmer in business, keep from defaulting on his payments, keep him from, you know, going out altogether so that we do not lose our farms the way they were. But I'm asking the question nowadays, in the information age, where we're at here with the superhighway, the information superhighway, basically running through everyone's living room. You know, why are farm subsidies still necessary? What good do they serve? Who does it help? You know, obviously, in some ways, it does keep some of the consumer prices down because some of the bigger farmers are actually taking profits right directly from the federal government. But, you know, let's face it, that's taxes. And, where, you know, do we need to keep paying taxes to keep our food prices down? Are they really keeping them that far down? Would not the market serve us better? That's the world that I'm going to. And somewhat in the room here who has typed in that this is the world of corporate farmers. Well, in a way, you know, this is quite true. Some of your most successful ones out there are the big corporations, the agribusinesses, so to speak. And, you know, they have their reasons for getting the way they do. Obviously, advances in technology in both farm machinery and the advances in chemistry to help make them more disease-resistant, kill off different bugs and whatnot, different diseases that would ruin crops have obviously come a long way and made us the most productive country in the world. But in this day and age, I mean, these things are available to everybody. They're available to the small farmer as well as the big farmer. And does the federal government still need to get involved in a farm business? I personally don't think so. I think it's time for them to get out entirely and whatever. I think if there's going to be a rearrangement of the market and the farms, then it needs to happen in the marketplace. I think it needs to happen democratically by us voting for which farmers make it with our dollars. And now, personally, I'm a supporter of small local farms. I love it. I love being able to go down and buy in fresh produce and fresh vegetables and be able to shake hands with the guy that grew it. You know, knowing full well that maybe at some point in time he will not only be a friend but a customer of mine. Indeed, in fact, they are, you know. a local farmer here back when I was in the business of selling cars and vehicles. Managed to buy a truck from me, and also when it was time for his son to have his first truck, brought his son over, bought a truck from him. And great people. You know, does a real good job. Pretty much an organic farmer. Does the whole organic thing, which I kind of like. You know, good, disease-free, pest-free, pesticide-free, preservative-free. You know, it's a beautiful thing is the way I look at it. And there's no reason that this man should be able to continue. He has to operate in a free market. There are no subsidies for him. So what are we saying here, folks? I'm asking the room. I'm trying to throw this right out there to everybody. Folks, do we still need farm subsidies? Terry Hunt's my good buddy. Haven't seen you for a while. Glad to see you tonight. Your hand is up. Take it away.
Well, thanks, Stevie. Here's my point of view, for what it's worth. Now, I think that the federal government, for corporate farming, needs to get out of the business and put it into the stock exchange and just get out of the business completely. But there are key important factors when you own small farms, and those things are state and federal write-offs. You know, there's things like conservational write-offs. You know, there's things, instead of paying 18% for your property, you can work it down to 12%. And this doesn't seem much like a much money to a corporate farmer, but you know, to just a small farmer, you know, it's a lot of money, you know, and there's some parts that are really good, there's some parts that are bad. The parts that I see that are good are within the states themselves. The parts that I see are bad are within the federal government. So I think the states, once again, need to manage their own affairs. But that's me. Thank you, BB, for your time.
Oh, it's good to hear from you. I think you're right. But even I think it should go beyond any government level whatsoever. I mean, if the government wanted to facilitate an information exchange amongst farmers to say, hey, who's growing what? You know, I'm going to do this year. Why don't you do that? You know, along that way. Yeah, that's fine. But I think other than that, they should keep out of it. You know, altogether the government. Say, you know, it's a business like anything else. It really is. And when government gets in and starts controlling businesses, you know, you always see a little bit of short-term benefits, but in the long run, it becomes very destructive of its own ends. And it's just not a good thing. It shouldn't be happening that way. You know, farmers are in a business, but every business out there is subject to the whims of the marketplace. It always has been. You know, and they're... And a farmer, of course, is, you know, he can only respond to a year or to a marketplace on a seasonal basis. But still, it's kind of like, you know, with the way the information superhighway is set up, it's all available there. You know, I mean, I think that they're probably would help them a lot to see databases of things that are moving. You know, like they just have a database of what vegetables sold where, what meat products sold where, how they're moving. And whatnot, you know, out of your local grocery stores. You know, not that this information isn't available to those that wish to go and really dig and find it, but if it was available on like a national database, these guys can make better decisions on what to move into each year. You know, they really could. You know, I mean, I look at the two or three big supermarket chains up here. You know, like the Big Y, the Price Chopper, Stop and Shop, the Super Stop and Shop. You know, even some of the huge ones around the country, the big Kmart superstores, the Walmart superstores, you know, that have that all handle groceries and meats and produce and whatnot. You know, there's no reason whatsoever that the data on what they're using and recommendations for the future can't come down off of you know, research provided by these people. It would help them. It would help. It would help the consumers. It would help the farmers. You know, all the way around. I don't know. Maybe what I'm looking at is a new business. Started up here, and maybe have somebody out there will listen to this and take a ball and run with it. You know, it could be a real worthwhile effort. I mean, you know, there are some farmers out there that are being real smart about a lot of things. You know, don't forget that we are moving into a global economy here, and some of our farm products are worth big dollars overseas. I mean, I still look at that. I hold as an example, and I'm sure listeners to the show have heard for years how I've touted those Michigan farmers that are growing ginseng for the Chinese market. You know, they're making a bounteous return up there. And the last time I checked on an M was 2-3 years ago. These guys are getting $32 a pound for ginseng that they're growing in Michigan. And they didn't even have to ship it. I mean, all I had to do was gather it out of their fields and take it up and right to their front gate. The Chinese were showing up there in trucks and paying them cash right there on the spot for it. And it was a beautiful thing. The Chinese believe that American ginseng is far more potent than what grows in China. So it's worth more to the Chinese over there than their own ginseng. You know, but that was just an example, and I'm sure there's other examples of this going on around the country. You know, even in the global marketplace, I look at stuff. I look at some of the organic distributors, you know, especially one that I worked with a few years ago. I mean, I was amazed at where this guy was buying some of his stuff. His tomatoes that he was getting, or tomatoes, as you like to call them, were all from Israel. Beautiful tomatoes. I mean, they were just gorgeous. All came wrapped, or not wrapped, but they all sat in their own little green cupcake papers, you know. They would just open them up, and they were just the tastiest. Well, I won't say the absolute tastiest, because I'm still very partial to Jersey tomatoes. But, I mean, they were beautiful. You know, and the guy was buying them. They were at a decent price, and people were buying them from him when they hit the stores. And that was a beautiful thing. But, it's you know, this is all stuff that he worked out by just doing a little research on the information. You know, finding out which farmers had what, where, what was available, and then going for it. You know, and I think if farmers had finally, you know, just unleashed the federal government off their backs, quit taking their money, they could move into areas that would be beneficial to everybody, including themselves. And personally, I'll be honest with you, I do not see prices going up on vegetables so much that they would become unaffordable to people. As a matter of fact, I really think that once it really hit the market in a correct way and farmers use the markets and use the information superhighway, I think prices would tend to come down on a lot of stuff. I think you would start finding a lot of products that you buy, like from California or, you know, from the West or from some of the other big farm-growing states, you know, maybe even produced a little more locally. You know, because you never know. Guys might find out that, hey, you know, this could be grown here. We can grow it cheaper. We can sell it for less and make more money. You know, so I think in this day and age of the information superhighway, I think that the whole need for farm subsidies is just done. At any rate, I'm glad to hear that Bush is going to veto this bill as it stands here. And I'm sure we'll hear more about this over the next couple of weeks. So good thing. Good things coming. All right, would anyone else like to weigh in on the farm issue subject here before I move on to another topic? I don't see any hands up, so I'm off with it. Oh, somewhat. You put your hand up there. Go right ahead. It's all yours.
Yeah, it's really nice to hear your show. I just ran across it, but I'm going to start with a simple blanket statement, and that to me, and we can work our way down from this, but to me, payment in kind is simply just a welfare program for the wealthy and for rich corporate farmers. It doesn't do jack shit for the small farmer.
Oh, I agree. And I mean, these are guys that are getting, you know, and the more acreage that they're sitting on, it gives them more money. So it's kind of like, yeah, you know, these guys might be into a big bank for all kinds of huge mortgage payments each year. But, you know, the rest of us are making these mortgage payments for them. You know, whether they live or die, you know, whether the crops fail or not. I think it's absolutely ridiculous. You're correct. Terry, you got your head up. Go ahead.
Well, I just, you know, if you're a small farmer, one person, you have to rotate crops, and you can't depend upon, oh, the price of corn is going to be higher this year against the price of beans. Because if you planted corn for 3 years, it's time to plant beans. You know, your soil can only take so much, and you still need the fertilizers and things of that nature to build the nutrition back up in your soil. So, yeah, BB, I mean, it's the corporate farmers now run the country, and the little guys, well, they're just the little guys, aren't they? That's all I have.
Well, I was going to
My father was a farmer, small dairy farm, back in the Carter administration. We were frozen wages, we got more frozen prices of milk and dairy products. And that milk has never really risen to meet the inflation, you know, the amount of inflation over the years. People, you know, get mad because it goes over $3 a gallon, when in actuality, if it kept pace with inflation, we'd be really paying a big amount of money. But you got to realize these farmers cannot come up with the you know, the amount of money that it's going to take to run the farm. It takes a massive amount of land with a small amount of profit on each one of those to really make any money. That's why small farmers out, big corporate farmers are in. And it's going to be that way, because nobody's going to go back to small farms again. They just won't do it. Because look what happened to the small farmers. They would be leery of it happening again. So I think small farmers are a thing of the past, unfortunately. And there's something in our culture and our tradition that I mourn with the passing of these wonderful people.
Oh, please, no. Green acres. You know, people have been leaving the farms in this country for 100 years. Farms have been getting bigger and bigger. And why should anybody be guaranteed that the price of their commodity rises with the cost of living? You know, if the price isn't going up, maybe we should have fewer farmers. We've had fewer farmers. And guess what? We produce more and more agriculture output. That's what's called productivity. Now, I don't want half the population living on the farm. You know, that's what they do in third world countries.
That's called corporate farming, is what you're in favor of then. That's all I needed to know. So you're in favor of corporate farming and throw the little guy out to... Well, that's all right. That's fine with me.
Well, I don't know if it's really... Look, unit hasn't been around as long as we had three rural countries. And I was brought up in farming country where everybody was a small farmer. It wasn't until the Carter administration that sped up to such a degree of the small farmer leaving because they were being run off. And that's where I saw the biggest loss in the small farm, right there. During that period of time started. My folks were a casualty of that time. You too, Terry? Well, you know what it's like then. And I know how fast it started then. So, people were leaving the farm unit. Absolutely. And you're right about that. But not in the massive numbers of the time of Carter.
Go ahead there, Mr. Unit.
Actually, it was in Reagan's term, too, but people have been leaving the farm for the past century. All you have to do is look at the number of people engaged in agriculture in this country. It's been on a long secular decline. And guess what? It's been declining. Fewer and fewer people are farming, and we're producing more and more agricultural output. That's called productivity. That's why we are a rich nation, because we can actually produce stuff with fewer and fewer people.
Well, I consider that socialism personally. I consider that, you know, the government is involved with your life from the womb to the tomb, you know. And, corporate farmers can make more money. They got 100,000 acres to deal with at a parcel, you know, versus a small farmer with 500 to 1,000 acres, you know. Well, yeah, I could see that. I guess that's what my uncle shot his brains out of his head, too. You know, that's another story. I'm over it. Thank you for the time.
Sorry to hear that. No, I understand where you're coming from there. I really do. But Yuga does have a point. Nowadays, and Megan, not to dismiss what you said, you're absolutely right. The inflation of the Carter years drowned lots of farms. And really, the socialism that took place there with subsidizing the big businesses helped them expand in ways that were, uncalled for, would not have happened any other way. No doubt. But nowadays, it's another story. I can look at it over the last 40 years, like you other fellows there. I spent every summer up here in Massachusetts, where I live at, out in farm country. And it's half the reason I moved up here when I was at the ripe old age of 26, because I wanted to recapture my youth living out in farm country. I grew up on a property that was right next to a dairy farm. I used to go over and help the guys milk the cows, so they'd get done early, we'd go play. I'll never forget how at the end of the season, we would always go to work for one of the corn farmers up there and go and hand pick all the corn, especially the corn that was meant for people's tables, not so much the cow corn and stuff like that, or feed corn, I guess you guys would call it. We always called it cow corn. But, that was all done by hand, whereas, even the small farmer that I deal with up here now has generally got machinery to do everything. It's not like the old days where he was, running one tractor with, various attachments going down it. They got combines. They got all kinds of equipment out there now. These farmers can all afford this stuff, and the Bush tax cuts really helped a lot with that, especially with, how they didn't have to write off the depreciation, didn't have to wait and write it off as depreciation. They could write off investments right in farm machinery. So that's exactly what they did. A lot of them went out and bought new stuff. It's the modernization, basically, the technology, I think, is what's bringing it along, out of pretty much, and which is why people are leaving the farms. They just don't have the use for all of the labor that it took years and years and years ago. It took, so many hands to go out into that field to pick a crop, to store it, to bundle it, to ship it, and blah, blah, blah. That stuff's all done by machinery now. I got one local guy over here, a very conservative gentleman, who doesn't really like me mentioning his name, but huge corn farmer, and basically does it all himself. And he's got a huge combine, he's got huge machinery. I'll bet he's got maybe 1,500, 2,000 acres that he farms, and it's all corn has always been growing the last couple of years, although I know he's going to go fallow this year. I'm pretty sure he will anyway, and grow alfalfa or something like that, because he's due for it. But it's just him. He has no use for any other people. Okay, Andrea from Italy, you have your hand up. The microphone is yours.
Okay, talking about agriculture and products, I would like to talk about quality and not only price, which seems to be the most important issue. Years ago, here in Europe, corn, flakes, things like that were pretty popular. All of them were imported by America in general. But today we have only one brand, which is Kellogg's. Why? Because all the others were banned because product with GMO, which are not allowed in Europe because the effects of these products are not known. Now Kellogg's is the only one company strong enough to produce this particular GMO free corn flakes. Now my question is this one: when you buy products of this kind, watch the price, but you'd better watch the little label on the side of the box. Maybe asking your consumer union would be a good idea, because your health is more important than your money. Thank you.
The reason why Europe doesn't allow GM foods is because they're protectionist. European agriculture has been propped up, subsidized, and protected forever. So And it's, people against GM foods are modern day Luddites. I don't know what's wrong with the corn you can use less pesticides on. It sounds like a good idea if you genetically modify it. But it's just a fact. Agriculture is changing like all industries change. But the most capital intensive industry in this country is oil refining. Second is agriculture. In the United States of America, agriculture is a capital intensive industry. It's not labor intensive. That's just the way it works in this country. And it seems to have worked quite well, because whenever the world needs food, they come here, don't they? Why? Because we can produce it.
Well, they might need food, but it's subsidized food. If I was given the same subsidies as the corporate farmers, I guess I could do quite well, but I'm not. Okay, that's my point. Just give me the subsidies that they get, and level the playing field. That's all. Level the playing field.
Yeah, let me say one thing. It's not a matter of protectionism, because as you know, one big American company is actually allowed to import in Europe. The problem is, they can actually produce genuine flakes and things. The other don't and cannot export to Europe. That's all.
Well, is it a matter of them not being allowed to export by us or not being allowed to be imported by you? That's basically what you're looking at. Now, I understand where the strictures are coming down over there, but that is just exactly what you said. It's protectionist. You got your greenies over there, your version of the greenies, whatever you guys call them, are probably the ones that are spearheading this movement. They would love to do that in this country, too. But over here, it's done a little more of a democratic process. What we have here are actually, and you'll see quite a few of them around, what they call cooperatives, or your organic stores, where a lot of the places here in this country will only buy from organically or from certified organic farms, and only sell certified organic produce to their customers. And some people flock to these places. But you will generally find that it's an elitist sort of thing. The prices in there are a lot more expensive. I don't personally think that the quality is any better. For the most part, it's a lot worse. If you see, especially with the fruit, fruit that hasn't been treated with pesticides and whatnot, generally pretty wormy, shriveled, not as good looking, not as tasty, doesn't have the color that I'm looking for, doesn't have the snap to it. I'm looking at least the one local co-op that's in my town here, which I've been in there twice, and that's it. I just don't care for it. I would much rather go to the commercial place around the corner here because I like the stuff better. But that's only during the winter. In the summertime, I go to the go to the local farmer. He's got the nicest stuff. That's the way I look at it. To be honest with you, I don't even know how his prices compare with anybody else's stuff. Although I will admit one thing. That the big chain up here, one of the big chains, the Price Chopper, does a really good job of its own on its selection. I had somebody come up and point something out to me there one day. I was having dinner at a friend of mine's house, and he was telling me, he says, you can go into the Price Chopper, and you can go over and you pick up a Green Giant, a bag, let's just say a bag of Green Giant frozen corn. And then you go over and you pick up a bag of the Price Chopper's frozen corn. And they're the same weight, and the Price Chopper's corn is probably going to be just as expensive as the Green Giant, or maybe a little less, but almost not enough to make price an issue. But when you open the two bags of them up and you put them in a pot next to each other and you look at them, the Price Chopper corn's got bigger kernels, better color, it's tastier, it seems like it was packed at a much fresher state than the Green Giant. just an all-over better quality of product. So at that point, I mean, you got to hand it to this one local grocer, you know, or at least he's local in the Northeast here. He's actually all over the Northeast. But they do a good job, you know, basically what's happening here. Now, the other big chain up here, the Big Y, a lot of what they do is, and they talk about how, you know, they deal with the local farmers. And, you know, their apple pies down there come from an orchard down in Connecticut. Down in Fairfield, Connecticut, it's just incredible apple pies. I mean, and the apples and everything are just, and I'm killing myself right now trying to trip over what the people's name is in this orchard. It begins with an L. I've met them. The lady is a freeper that owns the orchard. Good people, and they own a couple golf courses down there too, which is how I got to know them. But it's just unbelievable, you know, how these people will actually just buy as locally as they can. I think they do this mostly to keep their shipping costs down, but by the same token, they're buying the best of the local producers. So the guy that does the best job wins here. Yeah, I don't have a problem with that, you know. It's competition. That's what competition's all about, you know. You want to go out and beat them, you got to do a better job. Unit, your hand is up.
Yeah, you've got to be able to compete in the marketplace. And the way, you know, the way you do that is you usually have to, you know, up your scale. Or be able to produce such a high quality, you can demand a premium. Now, a lot of these farmers, small farmers, can do that. They'll produce high quality and they'll demand a premium and they'll give it. But, you know, why should agriculture be different than any other industry? You know, retail, mom-and-pop stores are gone, you know, because they can't compete. You know, bigger and bigger, and that's just the nature of that's what's been happening in this country in just about every industry for a century, because it's more efficient. There are economies of scale.
Yeah, well put. All right. I see that we have Mr. Hillary Knows Best come into the room here tonight. So I'm going to drop the farm topic, and I'm going to get down. I said I was going to do a little Hillary bashing, and I'm going to get in on it right now for the top of the hour here. All right. This is down off the AP about an hour before the show started tonight. And a commentary on this is going to be good. The battle against, this is the name of the article, and it's by Mike Glover off the AP, is Clinton Sees Opportunity in Climate Woes. Now, the battle against global warming means big economic opportunities as well as challenges for the U.S., Democrat Hillary Rodham Clinton said today, touting her energy proposals as she campaigned in Iowa. For this generation, climate change is our space race, said Clinton, speaking in a cavernous factory with giant wind turbines in the background. Clinton, who is pursuing the Democratic presidential nomination, is calling for the creation of a $50 billion strategic energy fund, coupled with tougher fuel efficiency standards, financed in part by $20 billion in green vehicle bonds. It's part of a package she calls the most comprehensive offer to tackle global warming. The climate crisis is also one of the greatest economic opportunities in the history of our country, she said. It will unleash a wave of innovation, create millions of new jobs, enhance our security, and lead the world to a revolution in how we produce and use energy. Global warming hits particularly hard at the poor, she said. One in four low-income families have already missed a mortgage or rent payment because of rising energy costs, Clinton said. She criticized President Bush for inattention to the issue. The president has systematically undermined our path to a clean energy future. Now, the Strategic Energy Fund would be roughly a third of a 10-year, $150 billion investment called for in her energy package. The program calls for reducing greenhouse gases by 80% from 1990 levels by 2050, and cutting imports of foreign oil by two-thirds by 2030. The import cuts would come through fuel-efficient vehicles, reduced electricity consumption, and increased production of an alternative fuel, she said. It's the biggest challenge we've faced in a generation, a challenge for our economy, our health, and our planet, said Clinton. It's time for America to meet it. It is time to get back into the solutions business. Well, she estimated her plan would create 5 million new jobs over the next decade, many in rural sections of the country. Clinton appeared at a factory that produces parts for wind turbines to spell out her proposals, which she said is a centerpiece of our effort to bolster the economy of rural sections of the nation by focusing on developing alternative energy sources. In her earlier speeches leading up to her task, she said she would pay for the plan by ending tax subsidies for oil companies. Subsidies, she argues, aren't needed anymore, with oil at more than $90 a barrel. Later in the day, Clinton touted her plan in an Orwellian middle school before her plan in a... As she spoke, Clinton coughed, cleared her throat, and regularly sipped water, blah, 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 blah. I'm trying to get to the one important thing I read in here. But at any rate, where it came back to, I don't know if I'd have read it in this one or another one, but she is talking about these green vehicle bonds. Now, get this, okay? She's talking about $20 billion in bonds to basically help the industry, the automotive industry, retool, in her words, so that cars can become more fuel efficient. As if soaking the consumers out there for $20 billion is all of a sudden going to make some miracle happen with gasoline, or make some miracle fuel appear on the marketplace to replace gasoline, and it's all going to happen because she is going to do this now and finance the automotive companies. Now, at this point in time, I got to throw a hand up and say, whoa, whoa, what do you mean that you are going to help fund our automotive industry? Great. Now, I said this back in April, you know, you heard the first death knells of the end of our automotive business when Congress got together and decided to hit the fuel efficiency standards and ratchet them upwards, thinking that legislation was going to cure engineering problems. Now, I said this before, that this is absolutely ridiculous. But this woman is so convinced that this can happen, that all we have to do is throw money at the problem, and we're going to cure it. Unbelievable. But pay attention. You are going to see people out there touting this energy plan, which does nothing more than rip off the public. Okay, she claims, and she has not come up with an alternative yet, but cutting our, what did it say here? Reducing by 2/3 the amount of oil that we import, which, you know, what's that going to do? It's just going to raise the prices of gasoline beyond where the normal people can have it. Once again, held only by the rich. You know, what else is she thinking about? Well, of course, she's got the other alternative fuel in mind, which she isn't mentioning too much because she knows the science behind it, being alcohol, corn. Yep. So stop and think about that once again. Now, I made the statement here before that if we end up switching over to an alcohol-based society, no one but the richest people will have it. The sun does not shine enough energy on the earth to meet the demands of the fuel users in the world. It just doesn't happen. I'm sorry. But you cannot grow corn fast enough to produce enough alcohol to meet the demand for fuel required at this stage in time. Aside from the fact that alcohol is a capitalist, is a capital-intensive situation anyway. You have to burn energy to make alcohol. That's all there is to it. You know, it's a byproduct of an energy process. You know, even if you decide to use the alcohol to make the heat that you're going to need to distill it out, just the way it works, it's not a good thing. So be prepared, folks. We're going to hear more of this coming down the road here from Ms. Clinton. And, you know, it all sounds good on the surface, but, baby, once you start looking at it deep, that woman is dangerous. And taking over the automotive industry is definitely one of the objects she has in mind here by throwing $20 billion in green vehicle bonds at it. And I'll tell you what, on top of all this, she's going to do a damn thing about global warming. You know, let's face it, not exactly a man-made situation here anyway, is it? All right, Unit, you got your hand up, and then we're heading to the break.
Well, you have to admire Hillary for her courage, her political courage, touting ethanol in Iowa. That really takes real political courage, doesn't it?
Yep, sure does. Sure does. But, well, it's not so much courage. She believes firmly that most people out there are stupid and will believe anything she tells them. The fact of the matter is, about 24% of the voting public are exactly in that boat. You know, that's the way I look at it. I look at it this way: if she's carrying half of the Democrats and half and the Democrats are half in this country, she's looking at 25% of the vote. Period. Stop. You know, she still hasn't reconciled herself with the fact that one of the other ones that's out there with her, campaigning along, doesn't get the nomination, may go out on his own and pull a huge voting block with him. And I do mean Mr. Barack Obama. You know, I really, really still at this point in time see him doing that. I do not see that man stepping down and ceding any power to her whatsoever or allowing her to run unopposed even in a general election. You know, it's, I mean, the way he's looking at it right now, she is the one he's running against. He ain't running against Republicans. He's running against her more than anything else. He has got a huge block of people out there that are supporting him in a big way. You know, there's no way I think I see him throwing in his block of voters with Hillary Clinton. I don't see him following her anyway. To be honest with you, I think we'd see a reverse of exactly what happened in 2006. Instead of the Republicans staying home, I think you see the Democrats staying home on the voting day. You know, just because they're so disgusted with the whole affair. Could well happen. But at any rate, we have hit the top of the hour here. Willie's got a few neat things he's going to run during the break. And we've got to let our producers at ASI and Hernco.com make a few bucks, run a few commercials. So we'll be right back. Folks, you are listening to the Politics Cafe, www.herncode.com and the ASI Radio Network. I'm your host, Mark Belcher, and we'll be back in about 4 minutes.
This is PalTalk, www.paltalk.com, the world's largest interactive voice and video community. PalTalk.com. Communication beyond words. In a time where good and evil have become completely distorted, one bright ray of light shines through. Politics Lobby 4. A modern-day battle of epic proportions. One light, many voices. Frontline with Pitt Burke. The Politics Cafe with Mark Belcher. And Leaks Dreamport with Randy Wright. Good versus evil. Light against dark. And fact versus fiction. Stay informed. Arm yourself. And prepare for the battle. www.politicslobby4.com. Now is the time.
ASI. Audio. Are you ready? Video. Interactive. And you can catch it all, that's right, at ASI.
Hello, my friends. America, and indeed the world, has reached a crossroads in history. The global war on terror is real, and our servicemen and women, as well as their families, have felt it firsthand. This is why I, everyone's favorite self-appointed activist judge, Chief Justice Randy Wright, am inviting you to visit politicslobby4.com. That's www.politicslobby4.com to show support for our troops. Join shows such as Frontline, Kit Gerald, and the Politics Cafe. Remember, we're in this fight together. Thank you.
You're listening to the Politics Cafe with Mark Belcher. Coming to you from Politics Lobby 4, join us at www.politicslobby4.com. That's www.politicslobby4.com. Or join us live in the Social Issues and Politics section at PalTalk.com. We'd love to see you there.
Thank you.
Say we're back. We lost it there for a little bit. Folks, you're listening to the Politics Cafe, www.herncoat.com and the ASI Radio Network. All right, I got one more little news item here. Something else to look forward to. And don't forget my call, which, by the way, we are exactly 1 year away from the general elections here. It will be held 1 year from tomorrow. And don't forget what I'm calling for should the Democrats win. General strike by all the producers of the world. Anyone out there that is working honestly for a buck and is tired of getting ripped off, tired of getting raided, tired of seeing your paycheck raided each week and going to socialists who would otherwise destroy you and your livelihood and your homes, your family, your morals, your institutions, you know, get ready. Don't forget that we are the ones that are enabling them to do this by giving them our tax money willfully and voluntarily. Taking our production and using it for their means, I just find it totally abhorrent. And they're going to find that they can no longer do that to us. You know, guess what? We've been giving it to them, and we're not going to give it to them any longer. But that's a year away. But don't forget, folks, you know, save up a little bit each month. Try to be able to get yourself through the month of November next year, right on through to Thanksgiving, and then we'll watch them sit and sweat as they have no money to spend on any of their programs. This right down off of Reuters News Network came down yesterday by Nick Carey. If the Democrats hold both houses of the U.S. Congress and take the White House in the 2008 election, America's struggling unions plan to trade their political support for a raft of labor-friendly bills. It's early to say, but if the Democrats were to take the presidency as well as Congress, said Bill Samuel, legislation director of the AFL-CIO Labor Federation, you know, read that lobbyist, this could be an opportunity for historic change. Analysts say big labor will push for legislation to make forming unions easier. You know, read that any way you want to there. Restrict free trade pacts, raise corporate taxes, and reform the creaking health care system. There is a real threat to the Democrats may take the White House and extend their majorities in the House and Senate with the support of the union, said Brian Darling, a congressional analyst at the Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank. In return, the Democrats would push measures like another minimum wage hike or no new free trade agreements that would be bad for the U.S. economy, Darling said. We are at a pivotal moment where the American people want to provide security and jobs for the next generation, said Anna Berger, Secretary-Treasurer of the Service Employees International Union. Like the 10 million member AFL-CIO, the 1.9 million member SEIU says it is planning the biggest mobilization in the U.S. labor movement's history ahead of the 2008 elections. Number one on their wish list is new members. Falling membership is one of big labor's biggest worries. U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics data show that union membership, public and private unions, fell to 12.5% of the U.S. workforce in 2005, from 20.1% in 1983. Ken Goldstein, labor economist at the Conference Board, a corporate network, calls that downward trend irreversible. The days when the unions represented one in four or five American workers are gone for good, he said. Legislation won't help. What the unions need is to overcome office workers' hostility to joining a union. But unions cite evidence such as the December 2006 national survey by Peter Hart Research indicating that 53% of U.S. workers, 60 million, would join a union if they could. Unions claim a big reason is a broken system for forming unions, which they say intimidates and discourages organizing. The remedy, they say, has already been introduced and is stuck in Congress, the Employee Free Choice Act. The bill would make it easier for workers to unionize using the card check system. that could form a union by signing a card rather than, as now, holding a vote. Unions see EFCA as a difference-making tool to organize at high-profile companies like package delivery company FedEx Corporation. FedEx competes with UPS, whose labor deal with more than 230,000 workers, represented by the Teamsters Union, is the single largest U.S. private sector contract. The EFCA was approved by the U.S. House of Representatives with 241 votes in March, and on a procedural motion garnered 51 votes in the Senate in June. But the White House has made it clear that President George W. Bush will veto the legislation. The 2006 elections swept Democrats into power in the 110th Congress. But on many issues, from Iraq to children's health care to the environment, simple Democratic majorities have been stymied by congressional rules on vetoes and filibusters. Two-thirds majorities are needed to overcome presidential vetoes, 290 votes in the House and 67 in the Senate. The Democrats control 233 votes in the House and 51 in the Senate. But analysts say even with a Democrat in the White House after 2008 and extended congressional majorities, the key roadblock for labor-friendly laws will remain in the Senate. Rules there allow only 41 members to prevent filibusters from ending, a keystone of minority power that, ironically, Republicans tried to cancel in 2005 amid Democratic opposition to Bush judicial nominations. Now the tables are turned. The Republicans have shown they can use the filibuster very effectively, said Jacob Hacker, a political science professor at Yale University. The party will continue to do so when it comes to labor-friendly bills. Economist Jared Bernstein at Economic Policy Institute, a liberal think tank, said 2008 may help Democrats woo GOP lawmakers away from stances held by Bush ahead of elections. If they show a willingness to compromise on this and other bills, they may be able to avoid a filibuster, he said. But Hacker was not that optimistic. The Senate vastly overrepresents union-friendly rural states, he said. Unions would be better off channeling energy into boosting membership on a local level than trying to surmount the legislative hurdle of the filibuster. Well, I'm going to tell you something. Unions, you guys want to increase your membership? Show that you can leave companies in business and not dying. You know, I think, and plus some of the methods that these people are using out there. You know, I don't know if, over in New York State, anybody over there works in the healthcare industry probably knows what the unions are doing over there in a big way, moving to rush places. And the rush is something that you have to witness to see. Basically, what happens here is union representatives will show up and stay in hiding. And this is a fact. This is exactly how they work. We're keeping a very low profile on the outsides of the building, wait for guards and other people to change shifts, find people inadvertently coming in and out of doors to smoke a cigarette, do something to that effect, whereupon they rush the building. They find an open door that is unguarded, and bang, four or five of them go running through, start handing out union cards, and start tacking up posters all over the place, and tacking up stuff on bulletin boards. And they keep moving at high speed while they're doing this, and while the guards chase them around or manage to either catch them or throw them out. Now, this happens in a lot of places. Disrupts a lot of stuff, especially in the healthcare industry, in hospitals and whatnot, where they're pulling this off. Rather disruptive tactic. But it's kind of like, you know, most of the people in these places look at these people and say they're nuts. You know, it's one thing that we have this employer here. And most of them are, pretty much aware of the fact that, you know, employment in the healthcare industry over there is already, under the guise of the government. And the government will come back and forth and has been holding them up for a lot of raises and a lot of other things in quite a few ways. You know, especially seeing as how the government is already subsidizing a huge portion of the healthcare industry over there. And it's funny the way they go about it because, you know, as we have said before here, money in this area is always going to be tight. Because the more of this that you give away for free, the more of a demand is placed on your whole system. And as such, the demands upon who is paying for that system become even greater and greater. And, you know, available funds get dried up pretty quick. And the way they combat this over there, or at least the way the state of New York manages to combat it, is when the funds get low and they find themselves behind the eight ball and having to make up, you know, where the payments are coming from, especially from Medicare and other of whatever New York State calls their socialized health system. Their whole response to it is to send representatives into various healthcare facilities and close them down, even if it's only temporarily. They will put a halt on all payments. And the way they do this is by nitpicking, going through the hospital, trying to find violations of basically, you know, like a TOS violation, terms of service. And they will go through and say, well, this person here isn't making the proper, keeping proper records. This person over here isn't getting proper care. This person here was left unattended while something occurred. And a host of other things. And these people are bonus at it. I mean, three or four of these people will come into your facility, do what they call a survey, and a week later they hand you a 1,000-page report with, you know, anywhere from 90 to 900 different violations that they have cited. And under the guise of this, and of course at this point in time, you don't have to, you know, they don't have to prove a thing. You know, what you have to do is defend yourself against all of these charges that were brought up. You have to address all of these issues. You have to satisfy this survey board that these issues have been settled, which, you know, how long is that going to take? You know, and it's depending upon what, first thing you're going to do is go out and find out whether it's a real issue or not, you know, which more often than not, it isn't. You know, it's amazing. You know, they'll have people come in and they'll say, you know, well, this person here can't speak English. Where is his interpreter? You know, only to find out later on, person could speak perfect English all along. Here, person was just making this up. But you just wasted 3 days and about 50 man hours proving just the opposite. In the meantime, what they do, though, is they just halt all payments to your facility. You know, bang, check, stop. And they could, they, you know, hold them up for anywhere from 30 to 90 days, you know, which could drive any of these businesses right out. But that's the way they do it, you know. Now, these are not poor big businesses, PTAB. You know, we get somebody in here crying, oh, poor big businesses. Aw. You know, we're talking about local hospitals. You know, especially the smaller ones in some of the rural areas will get nailed the first. And you got to understand that these are, no. You got to understand, my friend, okay, that these are all businesses that are, you know, that are in providing a service that is necessary. Okay, we're talking about health care here. Okay, when you are sick, who else do you go to? You know, well, there is nowhere else to go. Stop and think about that for a minute. Okay, and the ones that they prey upon are obviously the ones that are the weakest. You know, the newly formed ones, the ones that are small and don't have the resources to fight back, you know, things of this nature. The ones that don't have an army of lawyers waiting in the wings to counterattack immediately. This is the way they go about it. But, of course, they will still make them operate under their services. You know, you have to take people in that get recommended to you. You cannot turn anyone away. You can't do this. I mean, it's just, you know, aside from the Hippocratic Oath that they take, it's just unlawful for them to do it. But still, this is the way they work about it, you know. So you're basically forced to depend upon these people, you know, for a good portion of your income, for a good portion of the funding that's needed just to keep the doors open and the lights on. And, you know, they hold that sword over your head all the time, where they'll just come in there and just, you know, find whatever it is they can find wrong, and bang, off you go. All right, looks like we got a couple people with their hands up to make some comments on this. Have at it there, folks. Mike, you're up.
Thanks very much. I just like to ask you, are you a socialist? I mean, I just came in the room, and okay, and you were saying that the healthcare is private, and that's not good. But personally, I think it is good. I personally don't like socialism. I think capitalism rules because, you know, it creates jobs, creates opportunities that not, oh, right, no universal care. Now, I'm going to leave the microphone to Terry Hunt, because Americans need to make proper choices. Mike, we're in a room of Republican capitalists. Cool, I'm a capitalist, but I'm not Republican, because I live in London. Do you used to be in the army, Zia? Mike, don't talk to the room. Okay, I'm going to let the mic free.
Go ahead there, Terry. No problem. Welcome to the room there, by the way. It's hang out for a little while. We are hosting a radio show right now that is being heard around the world. I'm glad that you weighed in on that. While you folks can at least see what's happening here with the unions, you know, I kind of wandered off into healthcare, but the unions will be trying to make a huge comeback. you know. It's doing what they do, you know. They've got their problems out there. Don't forget how the Teamsters walked away from the AFL-CIO last year. You know, that was for no dumb reason. The reason that they had gone behind us was because they were sick and tired of watching their union dues being pushed towards putting Democratic candidates into office. You know, they did not like that whole idea, and as a result, the Teamsters, the biggest portion of the AFL-CIO, just got up and left it. Wanted nothing more to do with it. It's a good thing as far as I can see, you know. The Teamsters are probably still one of the few viable unions that are left out there. Teamsters, you know, I'll be honest with you, in my own memory, and I could be wrong about this, but I don't remember them ever really going so far as to close a business down. You know, they at least have not gone as far as the Auto Workers Union and damn near putting the Big Three out of business. Colbo, you got your hand up. Please weigh in.
Well, I've got a problem with the unions like the UAW chasing the auto business out. It's ridiculous where they're demanding that an assembly line worker that puts bolt A to nut B gets $25 or $30 an hour. That's ludicrous. That's ridiculous. That's causing the businesses to leave this country to get cheaper labor. I think the unions are having a hand in a lot of the businesses closing. I'm speaking more of labor unions. A lot of the other unions, public services unions such as law enforcement and stuff like that, they do have their purposes, safer working conditions, et cetera, but the labor unions are getting a little way out of hand. Like I said, I mean, a non-skilled worker getting $30 an hour to put a bolt in a hole. It's ridiculous, you know. That's my say.
Yeah, I understand where you're coming from there, you know. I really do. It's cars should be priced in the marketplace in a very competitive ideal. And I think each union worker, or each worker who is working on a car, should get a price of the car that goes down the line. You know, if they sell more cars, hey, you make more money. And they're going to sell more cars if there's more quality involved in the car, so do a good job at it. But if you're not going to do such a good job at it, you're not going to tighten that bolt if you put it in a hole. Well, you expect to sell less cars and expect not to make as much money. Expect to, you know, eventually go out of business with it. You know, that's the way it should look, you know. The car business got themselves off on the wrong foot. A lot of industries got themselves off on the wrong foot by not, you know, having pay tied to production. You know, I think it's a goofy move, but you know they've kind of dug their own hole there. Terry, you got your hand up. Go right ahead.
Yeah, this is the same thing. It's going back to, you know, what's right, what isn't right. But I can tell you one thing: when you get the federal government involved in these matters, you cause a bureaucracy. Those bureaucracies cost a tremendous amount of money on these taxpayers. It's the same way, and I'll go back to this farming, because I was knocked off it was antivirus. Anyways, I look at that, man, but I hear some people say, well, you know, it's fine and great that the government now it is going to ensure your farming. You know, they're going to take care of all your farming needs. And I suppose they'll do that from the womb to the tomb. And that's fine. That's great. That's all right. You know what? I can live with it. I don't care. You know? But it's just one thing leads to another. You know? And here we are now faced with the UAW. You know? And these people, God love these people. God love these people, because who would do that job? Who the heck would do that job? You know? But the qualifications are rubbing two nickels together, and you're hired. You know? And no, I wouldn't want to do that job. Do you understand? But for them to make... For them to have making more money than I had, I consider it an insult, you know. And that's why the Japanese basically are taking and have taken over the market. You know, look at the big three. Look at where they sit. Do you really want to buy stock in that companies? Terry Hunt is done. Beep, beep.
Go ahead there, Mike.
Thanks very much. All right. I just want to make a side footnote, right? Someone said something about being Republican and Democrats. Now, I've spoken to many Democrat supporters, and they seem like sick, self-hating people. You know what they say? They say that, oh, the plane didn't crash into the towers. They say it's a lie. And you know what they say? Can you believe it? We have these Islamo-Nazi fascists who want to kill everyone, and yet we have these self-hating Americans. It's just nauseating, you know? They turn around and say, we want to vote for Hillary Clinton or Barack Hussein Obama because they're progressive. It's nauseating. You know, our enemies might be probably saying, oh wow, look at this. Look how dumb our enemies are, you know? So, by the way, I started I understand that I'm on the radio show. I'd like to tell people that I was born in Baghdad. I came to London when I was 11 months old. I'm an English citizen, British citizen, and what I'd like to happen in Iraq, I want Islamo-Nazi fascism to be defeated, I want the Islamo-Nazi fascism to be destroyed in Iraq. Now, if Americans, whatever they want to do in Iraq, I'm sure that their intentions are honorable. They want peace and stability in Iraq. And since America leads the world, we got to side with the United States. That's all I have to say. Over to the admin.
Wow, my kind of guy. You're all right, Mike. You hit most of the problems facing this country right on the head. And you're absolutely true, you know. And one of the big things that really gets these people moving is the way the rich are in this country. How they got rich, how they stay rich, the fact that they're evil, that they're no good, that the money out there is corrupting them, it's corrupting everyone else. And it actually brought to mind quite a bit going on here today. Yeah, we're going to talk about capitalism here in a minute. I'm going to get around to it. I actually have one person up here. I'm going to go into a long diatribe here in a minute. But I'm, instead of holding up Rock's car for the next few minutes here, I'm going to let you have the mic probably weigh in on the subject, and then we're going to go off on a tangent. Go ahead there, Rockstar. Scar.
Thanks, BB. Hi, everybody. This is Sharon, okay? This is Rockstar. America seems pulled together. We're really working hard here. We're trying to make sure Hillary doesn't get... Hey, Natalie, how are you, honey? How you doing? Hey, Army wife, how's that family over there? They still over there? And, of course, my dear buddy Sue and Daryl and everybody. Hi, y'all. We're really, really trying hard here to make sure that Hillary isn't doing anything. Kicking butt, you know. Me and my old guy Virgil Good working hard. We've got about 3,200 Republicans here in my area, okay? So we've been busting butts. Let's pull America together. Let's make her great, keep her great. She's still wonderful. Oh, we are on the air. Hi, Willie. That's good. We love America. Let's go. We're Americans. We can get through this crap. You're Mike.
All right. Thanks a lot. Okay. Getting down there. Well, we got a couple of the guys, the foreigners, weighing in here, and I'm just too polite to interrupt them. So, Mike, or Andrea from Italy, go right ahead there. Mike, follow them up. And then, folks, just keep your hands down for a few minutes because I definitely got another way to go.
Okay, thank you. Just to say that it's 3 a.m. here in Italy. It's been a pleasure to stay with you guys. Thank you to the host. And good night, everybody.
Well, you're most welcome. Mike, go ahead. Take the mic.
Thanks. Right, I'd like to talk about other things that these people... I don't know what I'm allowed to say or not allowed to say, but, you know, if we remember in the 90s... Now, I don't know about the Clinton years, but what I do know is that he invited Arafat to the White House. And now... Hillary Clinton and Barack Hussein Obama, they want to invite Kim Jong-il from North Korea to the White House. They want to invite Ahmadinejad to the White House. Ahmadinejad, who's promising to wipe Israel and the U.S. out of the map. I mean, it's absurd. They might as well invite Osama bin Laden to the White House if that's the way they're going. You know, these people, what is wrong with these people? God forbid, if they were to go into power, what is going to happen to this world? I mean, the U.S. leads the world, and we ask you people, help us defeat these people, defeat these self-haters. I don't know who's the candidate. I mean, who is the candidate? Who is the candidate that you'll vote for? Is it McCain? Is it... I don't know. I don't know much about American policies. All I know is that if the Democrats get in, then we are screwed. Over to you, Terry.
Thank you, Michael. I tell you what, man, it's a pleasure hearing from you. I'm wondering myself, you know, from time to time. What happened to state rights issues? You know, are they now federal? Are they now all federal rights issues? Does everything now come under the federal government? You know, one thing, people sit there, they bash Bush, and they weigh him out, and maybe they should when it comes to money reform in this country. You know, he spent a tremendous amount of money. You know, I know that he's been strung up, you know, but I'm thinking that he's almost become a puppet. But nevertheless, there was an alternative that would have been far, far worse on this country and on this world. You know, and I just wonder where states' rights issues. That maybe this is something for BB to bring up. I mean, I don't know. You know, I'm not. I don't proclaim myself to be anything but me. You know, a non-educated hillbilly from the backwoods of Missouri. But let me know. Thank you. Go ahead, Mike.
Mike, the mic is yours. Try to keep it under 1 minute.
Thanks. Okay, here's my 1 minute. Now, in this country where I'm in, the UK, we've got many problems with immigration. I know you have it in the US with either Muslims, Mexicans, or any other race. But over here, it's getting really bad. I mean, people talk about multiculturalism being great, but they're setting up their own little cities in a city. Some of them are illegal, some of them are legal. In this country, can you believe it? It's like they're trying to take over. You know, and I can't understand what's wrong with this government in this country, because multiculturalism is a really bad thing, in my opinion. I think we should try and integrate. I'm in the UK, I'm an English guy, my allegiance is to the Queen. Okay, or my background is from Iraq. I care for Iraq, but I care about this country a great deal. You know, my allegiance is to this country. If there was a conscript, I would go and fight. As long as I'm an officer, since I've qualified to be an officer, because I've got a bachelor's in psychology, and I'm doing another one in finance. Mike Spree.
Alright, thanks a lot. Good to hear. Good to hear that you got those, you know, you got your head on straight there, Mike. This is a real good thing. All right, now I wanted to go a little bit, and we're talking about a little bit about philosophy here tonight. And one of the things that got tossed around was that money is being the root of all evil. A lot of people will look back and you will hear this statement, and I heard it again today, and it just brought to mind something that I had to come out and burden all of you with tonight. Maybe you're going to see this as a burden, maybe you're not. First thing I want to do, though, is definitely make a disclaimer or a qualifier, so to speak. You know, because the term, money is the root of all evil, was termed by one of my heroes of the world, a man named Jesus Christ. But I would have the qualifier being that Jesus Christ, when he was speaking about money, was not speaking so much of trade currency, but what was being issued by the Pharisees, by the priests in the temple, who were doing all the trading at the time. You know, there was a point in time, especially around the time of Jesus Christ, when basically the Jewish temples and the synagogues had taken control of all of the markets in Jerusalem, and had were basically they were no longer allowing a free market to occur and work throughout Israel at the time. You know, if people were coming into Israel to do any business, you know, as opposed to any other Middle Eastern city where you would just walk in there with all of whatever goods you had, you know, be it a herd of camels or a herd of sheep or a herd of goats or produce from your fields or something dug out of your mines or something that you harvested in some other manner and just took it into the market and began to trade for it, and trade as you will. The Pharisees had decided that this is no way to go. You know, what you will do is you will bring everything that you are bringing into the market to the temple first. And in the temple, we will purchase it from you, and we will not pay you in any usable currency anywhere else except for in the market. Something that they were basically issuing scrip at the time. They were issuing money. And that was the money that Jesus Christ was talking about. Now, it was the root of all evil. But, you know, now as we know, money today, it's a trade currency, and it has allowed a lot of things to happen. And I'm going to burden you with a little bit here about the actual uses of money, about where it really comes from, and about really what it's all about. And this is an excerpt from a book. The book is called Atlas Shrugged. It's by Ayn Rand. It was written back in the 30s. And it's this is a beautiful piece of literature, and I'm just going to whack you with it. I'm going to give you all some food for thought. And this is basically a guy named Francisco D'Anconia, who had overheard someone saying that money is the root of all evil, and that he was the typical product of money. Francisco spoke up. "So you think that money is the root of all evil," said Francisco D'Anconia. "Have you ever asked what is the root of money? Money is a tool of exchange, which can't exist unless there are goods produced and men able to produce them. Money is the material shape of the principle that men who wish to deal with one another must deal by trade and give value for value. Money is not the tool of the moochers, who claim your product by tears, or of the looters, who take it from you by force. Money is made possible only by the men who produce. Is this what you consider evil? When you accept money in payment for your effort, you do so only on the conviction that you will exchange it for the product of the effort of others. It is not the moochers or the looters who give value to money. Not an ocean of tears nor all the guns in the world can transform those pieces of paper in your wallet into the bread you will need to survive tomorrow. Those pieces of paper, which should have been gold, are a token of honor, your claim upon the energy of the men who produce. Your wallet is your statement of hope that somewhere in the world around you, there are men who will not default on that moral principle, which is the root of money. Is this what you consider evil? Have you ever looked for the root of production? Take a look at an electric generator and dare tell yourself that it was created by the muscular effort of unthinking brutes. Try to grow a seed of wheat without the knowledge left to you by men who had to discover it for the first time. Try to obtain your food by means of nothing but physical motions, and you'll learn that man's mind is the root of all the goods produced and of all the wealth that has ever existed on earth. Oh, but you say that money is made by the strong at the expense of the weak? Well, what strength do you mean? It is not the strength of guns or muscles. Wealth is the product of man's capacity to think. Then is money made by the man who invents a motor at the expense of those who did not invent it? Is money made by the intelligent at the expense of fools? By the able at the expense of the incompetent? By the ambitious at the expense of the lazy? Money is made, before it can be looted or mooched, made by the effort of every honest man, each to the extent of his ability. An honest man is one who knows that he can't consume more than he has produced. To trade by means of money is the code of the men of goodwill. Money rests on the axiom that every man is the owner of his mind and his effort. Money allows no power to prescribe the value of your effort except by the voluntary choice of the man who is willing to trade you his effort in return. Money permits you to obtain for your goods and your labor that which they are worth to the men who buy them, but no more. Money permits no deals except those to mutual benefit by the unforced judgment of the traders. Money demands of you the recognition that men must work for their own benefit, not for their own injury, for their gain, not their loss. The recognition that they are not beasts of burden, born to carry the weight of your misery. That you must offer them values, not wounds. That the common bond among men is not the exchange of suffering, but the exchange of goods. Money demands that you sell, not your weakness to men's stupidity, but your talent to their reason. It demands that you buy, not the shoddiest they offer, but the best your money can find. And when men live by trade, with reason, not force as their final arbiter, it is the best product that wins, the best performance, the man of best judgment and the highest ability, and the degree of a man's productiveness is the degree of his reward. This is the code of existence whose tool and symbol is money. Is this what you consider evil? But money is only a tool. It will take you wherever you wish, but it will not replace you as the driver. It will give you the means for the satisfaction of your desires, but it will not provide you with desires. Money is the scourge of the men who attempt to reverse the law of causality, the men who seek to replace the mind by seizing the products of the mind. Money will not purchase happiness for the man who has no concept of what he wants. Money will not give him a code of values if he's evaded the knowledge of what to value, and it will not provide him with a purpose if he's evaded the choice of what to seek. Money will not buy intelligence for the fool, or admiration for the coward, or respect for the incompetent. The man who attempts to purchase the brains of his superiors to serve him, with his money replacing his judgment, ends up by becoming the victim of his inferiors. The men of intelligence desert him, but the cheats and frauds come flocking to him, drawn by a law which he has not discovered, that no man may be smaller than his money. Is this the reason why you call it evil? Only the man who does not need it is fit to inherit wealth, the man who would make his own fortune no matter where he started. If an heir is equal to his money, it serves him. If not, it destroys him. But you look on and you cry that money corrupted him. Did it? Or did he corrupt his money? Do not envy a worthless heir. His wealth is not yours, and you would have done no better with it. Do not think that it should have been distributed among you. Loading the world with 50 parasites instead of one would not bring back the dead virtue which was the fortune. Money is a living power that dies without its root. Money will not serve that mind that cannot match it. Is this the reason why you call it evil? Money is your means of survival. The verdict which you pronounce upon the source of your livelihood is the verdict you pronounce upon your life. If the source is corrupt, you have damned your own existence. Did you get your money by fraud? By pandering to men's vices or men's stupidity? By catering to fools in the hope of getting more than your ability deserves? By lowering your standards? By doing work you despise for purchasers you scorn? If so, then your money will not give you a moment's or a penny's worth of joy. Then all the things you will buy will become not a tribute to you, but a reproach. Not an achievement, but a reminder of shame. Then you'll scream that money is evil. Evil because it would not pinch hit for your self-respect. Evil because it would not let you enjoy your depravity. Is this the root of your hatred of money? Money will always remain in effect and refuse to replace you as the cause. Money is the product of virtue, but it will not give you virtue and it will not redeem your vices. Money will not give you the unearned, neither in matter nor in spirit. Is this the root of your hatred of money? Or did you say it's the love of money that's the root of all evil? To love a thing is to know and love its nature. To love money is to know and love the fact that money is the creation of the best power within you, and your passkey to trade your effort for the effort of the best among men. It's the person who would sell his soul for a nickel who is the loudest in proclaiming his hatred of money, and he has good reason to hate it. The lovers of money are willing to work for it. They know they are able to deserve it. Let me give you a tip on a clue to men's characters. The man who damns money has obtained it dishonorably. The man who respects it has earned it. Run for your life from any man who tells you that money is evil. That sentence is the leper's bell of an approaching looter. So long as men live together on earth and need means to deal with one another, their only substitute, if they abandon money, is the muzzle of a gun. But money demands of you the highest virtues, if you wish to make it or to keep it. Men who have no courage, pride, or self-esteem, men who have no moral sense of the right to their money and are not willing to defend it as they defend their life, men who apologize for being rich will not remain rich for long. They are the natural bait for the swarms of looters that stay under rocks for centuries, but come crawling out at the first smell of a man who begs to be forgiven for the guilt of owning wealth. They will hasten to relieve him of that guilt and of his life as he deserves. Then you will see the rise of the double standard. The men who live by force yet count on those who live by trade to create the value of their looted money. The men who are the hitchhikers of virtue. In a moral society, these are the criminals, and the statutes are written to protect you against them. But when a society establishes criminals by right and looters by law, men who use force to seize the wealth of disarmed victims, then money becomes its creator's avenger. Such looters believe it is safe to rob defenseless men, once they've passed a law to disarm them. But their loot becomes the magnet for other looters, who get it from them as they got it. Then the race goes, not to the ablest at production, but to those most ruthless at brutality. When force is the standard, the murderer wins over the pickpocket. And then that society vanishes in a spread of ruins and slaughter. Do you wish to know whether that day is coming? Watch money. Money is the barometer of a society's virtue. When you see the trading is done, not by consent, but by compulsion. When you see that in order to produce, you need to obtain permission from men who produce nothing. When you see that money is flowing to those who deal not in goods, but in favors. When you see that men get richer by graft and by pull than by work, and your laws don't protect you against them, but protect them against you. When you see corruption being rewarded and honesty becoming a self-sacrifice, you may know that your society is doomed. Money is so noble a medium that it does not compete with guns, and it does not make terms with brutality. It will not permit a country to survive as half property, half loot. Whenever destroyers appear among men, they start by destroying money. For money is men's protection and the base of a moral existence. Destroyers seize gold and leave to its owners a counterfeit pile of paper. This kills all objective standards and delivers men into the arbitrary power of an arbitrary setter of values. Gold was an objective value, an equivalent of wealth produced. Paper is a mortgage on wealth that does not exist, backed by a gun aimed at those who are expected to produce it. Paper is a check drawn by legal looters upon an account which is not theirs, upon the virtue of the victims. Watch for the day when it becomes marked, or watch for the day when it bounces, marked account overdrawn. When you have made evil the means of survival, do not expect men to remain good. Do not expect them to stay moral and lose their lives for the purpose of becoming the fodder of the immoral. Do not expect them to produce when production is punished and looting rewarded. Do not ask who is destroying the world. You are. You stand in the midst of the greatest achievements of the greatest productive civilization, and you wonder why it's crumbling around you, while you're damning its lifeblood, money. You look upon money as the savages did before you, and you wonder why the jungle is creeping back to the edges of your cities. Throughout history, money has always been seized by looters of one brand or another, but whose method remained the same. To seize wealth by force and to keep the producers bound, demeaned, defamed, deprived of honor. That phrase about the evil of money, which you mouth with such righteous recklessness, comes from a time when wealth was produced by the labor of slaves. Slaves who repeated the motions once discovered by somebody's mind and left unimproved for centuries. So long as production was ruled by force and wealth was obtained by conquest, there was little to conquer. Yet through all the centuries of stagnation and starvation, men exalted the looters as aristocrats of the sword, as aristocrats of birth, as aristocrats of the bureau, and despised the producers as slaves, as traders, as shopkeepers, as industrialists. To the glory of mankind, there was, for the first and only time in history, a country of money. And I have no higher, more reverent tribute to pay to America. For this means a country of reason, justice, freedom, production, achievement. For the first time, man's mind and money were set free, and there were no fortunes by conquest, only fortunes by work. And instead of swordsmen and slaves, there appeared the real maker of wealth, the greatest worker, the highest type of human being, the self-made man, and the American industrialist. If you ask me to name the proudest distinction of Americans, I would choose, because it contains all the others, the fact that they were the people who created the phrase to make money. No other language or nation has ever used these words before. Men had always thought of wealth as a static quantity, to be seized, begged, inherited, shared, looted, or obtained as a favor. Americans were the first to understand that wealth has to be created. The words to make money hold the essence of human morality. Yet these were the words for which Americans are denounced by the rotted cultures of the looted continents. Now the looter's credo has brought you to regard your proudest achievements as a hallmark of shame, your prosperity as guilt, your greatest men, the industrialists, as blackguards, and your magnificent factories as the product and property of muscular labor, the labor of whip-driven slaves like the pyramids of Egypt. The rotter who simpers that he sees no difference between the power of the dollar and the power of the whip ought to learn the difference on his own hide, as I think he will. Until and unless you discover that money is the root of all good, you ask for your own destruction. When money ceases to be the tool by which men deal with one another, then men become the tools of men. Blood, whips, and guns, or dollars. Take your choice. There is no other. And time is running out. And with that, Terry, I'm going to give you the mic. You've had your hand up there a little bit, but I just wanted to read that to you folks out there today. You know, one of the highest reasons that I love this country is for those words right there. For the fact that people have been free to make money, free to use their mind as they saw fit, and that only if they held their own high moral principles were they able to make their way through the world. You know, and this goes right down to the least among us. You know, to the man that goes out and honestly works at a job using all the talents he can to make as much money as he can for himself and his family. As long as he's doing it honestly, come on, let's face it, he is doing it. And this country, as long as it stands, and it stands free, will always take care of the least among us. That's why you see this country being the greatest prosperity in the world. It's why we have the most progress. It's why we have, you know, the poor people who run around in designer jeans and designer sneakers, all carrying iPods and carrying cell phones. You know, our country got to be great because we understood what money was, how money was created, and why, you know, we have gotten to where we are today. You know, this is very important. You know, when I said out there this morning to you folks that, you know, people who were the industrialists of this world and how they were some of the greatest heroes, I meant it, and I still mean it, and I still think that these are the people that you had best not be keeping up looting and mooching and whatnot. Other reasons why you want to keep Democrats out of the damn house, out of the White House, because that's exactly how they look at your American industrialists. Blackguards, greedy people. You know, when these people with their ideas and their money have provided more for us than you know, any other country on earth. You know, to me, it's a beautiful place here. It's a beautiful place because we're free. And our prosperity rests upon that freedom. You take away that freedom, that prosperity is going to go right behind it. All right. Terry, I'm going to give you the mic. Got 1 minute left, and I'm going to have to close it up here.
I'll make it real short. It seems like everything you had to say regarded somewhere Solomon's philosophy. I'll leave it this to you. Behold how good and how pleasant it is for brethren to dwell together in this unity. It is like the precious ointment upon the head that ran down Aaron's beard, that went down his skirts and his garments. As the dew of Hermon, and as the dew descended upon the mountains of Sinai, for the Lord commanded the blessings, even life, forevermore. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome very much. Those are wise words. You know, it is true. It is a blessing from God. There's no doubt about it. You know, that blessing being, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And that pursuit of happiness, you know, could not have happened without life and liberty, you know, right on top of it. All right, next week, folks, we're actually going to get very heavily into Duncan Hunter next week. I am going to be extolling a lot of his virtues, a lot of his values, and we're going to start talking the man up. Somehow or another, we will attract him to come to this show and talk to us. And I'm really going for it. I've been reading his website much in detail, reading where he stands and what he's doing. And I like the guy, and I think that he deserves just as big a shot as either Mitt or Giuliani. And certainly is a total effective weapon against Hillary Clinton. Any other Democrat that might get it. But in the meantime here, folks, I have got to close up the shop here. Maitre D' has already disappeared, took his keys with him, locked the door. I don't know what I'm going to have to go find my own keys here. The waitresses have already piled all the tables high with the chairs. The lights are dim. But, however, the bar, as always, will be open, so you're all welcome to hang out inside the bar here, inside Politics Lobby 4, secure our Borders chat room, and have a good old time. But for the show, we've got to close it up. Thank you very much for listening tonight, folks. It's been my pleasure. I'm your host, Mark Belcher, and we will see you next week at the same time. You have listened to the Politics Cafe, www.hernco.com, and the ASI Radio Network. Good night, folks. We'll see you next week.